Welcome to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. This is Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and in today's installment, we'll be visiting the Stearns History Museum and hearing excerpts from a presentation given by retired Army Colonel Edwin Bud Nakasone. Nakasone witnessed the attacks on our military bases on December 7th, 1941, as a child from his home in rural Hawaii, and is a graduate of the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Language School and served as a student of the Japanese language at Fort Snelling beginning in 1945, and was sent as a linguist to Japan during the occupation from 1946 to 48. Nakasone is a University of Minnesota graduate and professor emeritus, having taught for 33 years at Century College in White Bear Lake. His presentation is part of the Stearns History Museum's partnership with the Smithsonian and their traveling exhibit, Righting a Wrong, Japanese Americans in World War II and Minnesota's Secret Language School. To listen to the entirety of Edwin Bud Nakasone's presentation, including the question and answer session that goes on for over an hour, you can find that on our website at kvsc.org, on the podcast and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab. And now, retired Colonel Edwin Bud Nakasone.
Yoku irashaimashite, de domo arigatou gozaimasu.
I can speak it.
Well, let me begin by telling you that I was born in Hawaii, and this was the year 1927. How old does that make me?
92.
Hai, so desu. That's right. 92 years old. I'm still walking around, okay? Feeling good. Let me say a few words about early Hawaii. It was a matter of having to come from Japan for my parents and to work in the sugarcane fields. And we, as young people, would also work in the pineapple fields during the wartime period. It was very, very hard work. It was 35 cents an hour. Every Tuesday, we had to go not to school, but to work in a plantation. That was my early life. Now, I want to start off by telling you that things were getting very rough in foreign relations between Japan and the United States come December 7, 1941. I was very aware of all that's going on because I liked to read the paper. My dad just got back from Japan 1 month before the war started. And I knew times were getting rough. And as a result, we were hoping it would get home. And it caught the last ship home from Yokohama. What was I doing that day? It is now December 7, 1941. I'm having breakfast, looking westward over towards the Waianae Range. There's Schofield Barracks. There's also Wheeler Army Airfield close by, 3 miles away from my home up in the heights of Wahiwa. And as I looked that way, having my breakfast, and there is Schofield Barracks, and behind Schofield Barracks, there's the Waianae Range. And the Waianae Range says dip a pass, and it's called Kole Kole Pass. And as I looked that way, I saw little specks coming through. 15, 20, 25 planes now coming through. They swoop down towards Schofield Barracks. They spray machine gun bullets all over Schofield Barracks. No bombs were dropped there. They climbed up. Wheeler Army Airfield is no more than 3 miles next to Schofield Barracks. All the planes were out there on the tarmac. And these 25 planes came down. And one bullet would go through three of these planes. What had happened was this. The commanding general of the U.S. Army did not realize that we Nisei, Japanese American, Issei and Nisei, were very law-abiding people and would never do anything like sabotage against the U.S. Army. And they were afraid they would be sabotaging the planes, and they had him corralled all on the tarmac, not in the bomb shelter area. And so the Japanese pilots could not believe what they have seen. I saw the bombs coming down. boom, boom, boom. I see all the planes. Remember I told you I'm no more than 3 miles in the heights area. I could see these very clearly. And the bombs explode among the planes, and the planes all ablaze. It was very, very dangerous time for us. The warehouses, the hangars were all blown up. People were killed at that time. And I said, I ran back in, turned on the radio, waked up the rest of the family, said, wake up, everybody. War is here, the Japanese are attacking us, attacking us. No more do I say that. I walk outside, overlooking the front yard, a plane zooms by. I see the red ball underneath the wings and fuselage. And I see the pilot's cockpit open. And I see a scarf, a la Snoopy, the white scarf. I really saw it. And the pilot, I could see the pilot no more than 250 feet up in the air. Zoomed on my home. This is another interesting person. Young man, he was about 28, 29 years of age at that time. His name, Ensign Takeo Yoshikawa. Ensign Yoshikawa. Very interestingly, this man kind of failed or stepped, failed out of the Etajima Naval Academy of Japan, akin to our Navy Academy, all right? And so, he was the one who came in early. He being now a reserve ensign, reserve naval ensign, he was put into the idea of becoming a spy. And so he became one. He came in March of 41. And so he was one of the first ones there. He immediately reported to the Japanese consulate in Honolulu. And every day, this man would go out. And he would go to a restaurant that is still in operation, Natsunoya restaurant, all right? And he would make believe that he was a good customer drinking beer and wine until the last stages of daylight. Every night for about 3 months straight before March 1941. And then the boss got tired of chasing him out of the restaurant. And so he said, let that man be, he'll go out by himself. Well, 5 o'clock in the morning, this man already had his binoculars with him, and bring it up to him, he would see Pearl Harbor right before him, and he knew every ship. There were 90 ships there. He knew every ship, and he had them all drawn up to exactly what part of the harbor they were on. And wow. This he'll send back in code back to Tokyo. Okay, now that's Ensign Yoshikawa. The attack went on, as you know, and all the battleships were hit by the torpedoes and bombs. And at the end, I want to talk about this one man, Ensign Nishikaichi. It says here, after attacking Oahu December 7, 1941, he was to meet with a bizarre misadventure on the Hawaii island of Niihau. You all know where Niihau is? Hokkaido. Okay. Niihau is next to Kauai. Kauai. Yeah. It's no more than 19 miles away from the island of Kauai. Well, the ships coming down from Japan, from the northern area, 260 miles north of Oahu, north of Pearl Harbor, all right, all the pilots were told to come back towards them. They would be gathered in north of Kauai, all right? And so when they attacked, they came back to Kauai area, but Nishikaichi's plane got hit with a bullet through his fuel line. And so before he could reach Kauai, he was going sputtering already, but he finally saw an island off Kauai. And this island was 19 miles long and about 8 miles wide. And it was occupied by all Hawaiians, about 280 Hawaiians. Mm-hmm. And he could see, boom, 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 landed. He hit his head on the cockpit and They were knocked unconscious, all right? And the Hawaiians, about 280 Hawaiians there, they could not believe a plane come down. The Hawaiians all lived in the old Hawaii of 1880s. And so no radio, no newspaper. They spoke Hawaiian only, all right? Of course, naturally, no television in those days. Well, what happened is this. With this man being knocked out, a couple of Hawaiian gentlemen went up to cockpit, opened up cockpit, and grabbed his papers, charts, and so on, and grabbed his pistol. And they left him there. He gets up, and they finally get him into a house and lock him up over there. And he sees a man going by, looked like a Japanese man. Remember I told they were all Hawaiian, 280 Hawaiians there, but there was a Japanese man who was the bookkeeper. And he says, Anone, Anone! Nihonjin desu ka? Nihonjin desu ka? Are you Japanese? Are you Japanese? And the man says, Hai! He couldn't figure out what's going on. This man is not supposed to be there because he's speaking Japanese. Only Hawaiian's supposed to be there. Well, help me, he says. And this man, not knowing anything, helped him, put him into another house, and locked the door, and gave him a pistol. Later on, when they went around to go into every Hawaiian home looking for the charts and a pistol, they finally came to this man's house, whose name was this one here. His name is Benjamin Kanahele. Big Hawaiian man, 6 feet 2 inches, all right? And they came to Benjamin Kanahele, and with his pistol, said, papers. He was looking for his chart. He was afraid that the charts were given over to the American authorities. The charts would show where they came from, the attack on Pearl Harbor. And so he would not give up. And so finally, this man approached. Nishikaichi, the pilot, approached Kanahele and said, give me papers. And Kanahele did not know what he was talking about. So this pilot shot him. Boom, boom, boom. Three times hit the man in the stomach, leg, shoulders, but still he was alive. And so what happened? Benjamin Kanahele, big Hawaiian guy, picks up the Japanese small pilot, and dashes him across the rocky outcrop. And he had his wife, who grabbed the stone and bashed the pilot's head in. Yeah, that's what happened in that Battle of Niihau.
You're in tune to 88.1 FM KVSC and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota. Today we're at the Stearns History Museum with excerpts out of a presentation by retired Army Colonel Edwin Bud Nakasone. And we've just heard about his personal experiences after witnessing the attacks on Pearl Harbor from his rural Hawaiian home. To listen to the entirety of his presentation, you can find it on our website at kvsc.org under the Podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab. And as we rejoin the conversation, Colonel Nakasone talks about his service to the United States as he came of age and joined the U.S. Army's Military Intelligence Service Language School, which happened to be located right here in Minnesota.
Okay, now, time comes, the talk that I have here today is from Pearl Harbor to Fort Snelling. Okay, well, during the war, we needed to have linguists, those who can understand the Japanese language, write it, read it, and interview and interrogate prisoners of war with it, with the language. There was a school that was set up here before the war. It started November 1, 1941, 1 month before the attack of Pearl Harbor, or almost 1 month. And it was in Presidio of San Francisco. Okay, but now war came, that was November 1 that they started with 100 students. And most of the students were good, they gotta be good in Japanese because both Colonel Rasmussen and General Weckeling scoured the US Army country to find out if they have any Japanese linguists. They were amazed to find hardly anyone And none of the Enisei could do so, but there were some, and the some were called Kibeis. You know what Kibei means? Ki means to return. Bay means rice. Rice. We're a rice country. Return to America. So these guys were people who were sent at an early age, usually in the high school period, back to Japan to be with their parents, to either their grandparents, and learn the language and become companions to their grandparents. And these were the Kibeis, and they went to Japanese language school and became experts in the Japanese language. And my friend Al Yamamoto was one of those. Al's gone now. But anyway, he was a Kibei, born and raised in Seattle, but went back to Japan to be schooled in Japanese language and stayed there over 7 years. All right? Well, anyway, Kibeis were the ones who made up most of the student enrollment in the language school. And the language school opened November 1, 1941. War came, and they had to move the school out from California. Where else could they go? Well, they thought, gee whiz, they asked every governor in the middle area, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, and so on. And all of them said, don't send any of those people to us. All right. Because Colonel Rasmussen and General Weckling wanted a community, a place that would accept these people, not only they being here, but also accept them as equals and accept them as those who can be trusted to be in their community. And so one man stood up, and that man was Governor, tell me, who was the governor? Governor Stassen. Yes. Yeah, Stassen was the one who said, yeah, we'll accept them here, we'll accept them here. And so in May 1942, they brought the school from California all the way to Camp Savage, Minnesota. And because these people were all so good, as you see in the exhibits, all so good in language, most of them were Kibeis, those who had already had training in Japan, Japanese, all right? And these were excellent students, and they were here, and they studied hard at camp. Come on.
Savage.
Right? And it became crowded because many of the immediate commanders in the field said, we don't want any so-called Japs over here and so on. But as it turned out, these were the ones who translated, who interrogated, who espionaged and all those against the Japanese army. And so with this, these guys began saying, give me more, give me more. Mm-hmm. And they wanted more people of Japanese background, Niseis, Kibeis especially, and so on. And so the school blossomed out from 100 people, to almost 3,000. And so they moved them from Savage, the Savage too small, and they brought them to a place called Fort Snelling. That's where I joined them. I was not secret anymore, but anyway, the building that I'm in, that I was in, is still standing there. You know where the round tower is? The first building next to it, that was Company C. I was in Company C, all right? And that building is going to be renovated to become the visitor's center right now. Right? Yeah, they're not giving up on that building. So that's how I came to Minnesota. Now, I was drafted in August of 45. And I was thinking, gee, the war is going to be over by this time. By the time I got drafted, a few days after the war ended. Now, what the heck's going to happen to us? But we had all kinds of good vibes. My cousin, for instance, who was already here at Snelling, had said, Minnesota is a wonderful place. They really accept you as a person, and they have no bad vibes against the people of Minnesota. There are jobs here too. And so many of them came to Minnesota and liked Minnesotans. And so from that point on, you had a growing Nisei population, all right? And so with this, you have how Fort Snelling came to be a focal point as far as the Defense Language Institute was concerned. But Fort Snelling was old, and many of the facilities could not be changed without huge amount of expense. And so they decided to close down Fort Snelling. And Fort Snelling was closed down August of 47, yeah. And with this, they moved the school all the way over to a place back to California, Presidio of Monterey. So I was moved, I went cross country by troop train all the way to Monterey, California, where I graduated from the Army Language School, all right? And there I graduated from Presidio of Monterey's Army Language School, which is still going on today as a Defense Language Institute, where they teach at least 18 foreign languages. All right, beautiful place, yeah. And so when I graduated, they sent us home and sent us home for 2 weeks furlough. And from there we went on to Japan to become part of the occupation force. And I was part of the occupation force at a place called Asaka, Saitama King, Japan. And I was with the 168th Language Detachment, assigned to headquarters, 1st Cavalry Division. It was very, very interesting duty. I liked it very, very much. All right. And so I'm now open for any questions. If I can answer them, I'll try to.
I have heard that although they put Japanese from the West Coast into camps, that they didn't take any Japanese from Hawaii. Is that true?
No.
It isn't true.
In fact, the fact that Japanese Americans became good soldiers and would fight hard for America was the immediate Hawaii people who were in the 100th Infantry Battalion, and then later on expanded into 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and they fought in Italy, and they fought so well that the U.S. Army said, we want more of them. And then in the meantime, you had people who had gone over to the over to the Southeast Asia campaign, and they became the interrogators, the interpreters, the translators, and did such wonderful work out there that they said, send us more. And that's how we became more than 6,000 of us who became part of the translator corps out of Fort Snelling. Yes, sir.
Did you speak any Japanese before you went to the language school?
Yes, I did, because we know to communicate with our parents, we have to speak language. Oh, that's a good question. And then we of Japanese descent in Hawaii and in California, other places, we had to go to Japanese language school 1 hour after English public school was over. And that was very hateful for us. We wanted to play with all other kids out there playing football or baseball and so on, but we couldn't. We had to go to Japanese language school. And we had Japanese language school training 6 days a week, Monday through Friday, 1 hour after public school, and on Saturdays, 2 hours.
But I wanted to ask, when you were in Japan during the occupation, how were you treated? Did you get any harassment? Because I've read some books about Japan and how the Japanese people suffered because of the emperor who wanted to, you know, conquer all these countries. And, you know, they were so close to starvation, a lot of these people, and had to give up so much. So when you went there, did you see that?
Yes, I did. I want to say a few words about that. About, we call it onion teas, tamanegi. And this is the way it was, because they would have the ordinary Japanese, the fine kimono, ne? Going out on the train to barter the kimono with more vegetables, or more, especially rice, ne? And try to bring that rice back home. But sadness of it all was that at that time they had a limit as far as the amount of food a family could have. And so what was sorry was that these people had already gone into the country to give up their fine kimono and to get the rice, extra rice. But there was a certain amount of rice you could have in your family, for a family of five or whatever it is. And the police would gather all these people up in Tokyo. I saw that in Tokyo Central Station. And they would have them put down all that they had borrowed on the platform. And they would give them only so much, and the rest all into a central stockpile. Yeah, it was sad for them. That's why they would give up their clothing. That's when their tears come out, because their fabulous clothing, going kimono and so on, and whatever they got back could not be used for food yet. That's what they went in the field for. Yeah, it was pretty tough for food people, for food going in there. And one thing I did not enjoy in my stint as an occupation person, I would often be called upon to become an interpreter for the MPs, military police. And the military police would gather all these people, especially in the train stations, young ladies who had to sell themselves in order to gain money for their home and so on, for their food. And these people were then sumptured off into U.S. Army health exam stations. It was kind of sad to see that, yeah. And I had to be the interpreter as far as, and kochira, kochira, this way, okay, all right. So it was interesting duty, but still, I was able to get away and come home. Any further questions? Well, as I've said, if you are interested in the book, I've got a book there, go for $20. And then beyond that, I'll be here for a little while longer. So if you want to come up here and ask me questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
And you've been listening to the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota here at 88.1 FM KVSC, and a presentation from retired Colonel Edwin Bud Nakasone at the Stearns History Museum about his experiences with Pearl Harbor, the secret Japanese language school, and his service in Japan during the occupation. For links to more information on this and other exhibits at the Stearns History Museum, you can find it online at stearns-museum.org, or you can find many of them on our website at kvsc.org under the Area Events tab. Also on our website at kvsc.org, under the Podcasts and Untold Stories of Central Minnesota tab, you can find a recording of the entirety of his presentation, including all of the question-answer session that followed. This has been Arts and Cultural Heritage producer Jeff Carmack, and the Untold Stories of Central Minnesota is made possible through funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It has been produced at KVSC, a proud member of Amper's Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities.